2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 165, The Spirit of Africa, participant Catherine Nesbitt.
Since 67, and Catherine would come back to the States, work a while, save her money up, and head back to Africa and do wonderful work in delivery and in research and all sorts of wonderful activities, which I'll let her describe to you. So I give you Catherine Nesbitt.
Jumbo. Habariaki.
Jumbo. Missouri Sana? Okay. We got our
Swahili beginnings. And I am happy to be here.
A little surprise. Actually, Molly, when she emailed me about coming, I was in Africa. So
so it was very authentic.
Afrique Noire, or Sub-Saharan Africa, as it is called, is a magical world of color, space, and beauty, unlike any other. It will envelop every one of your senses and even make you aware of a few that you never knew existed. So, here. So let's look at Africa first. Let's take a good look at Africa. It is wonderful. The very continent itself is replete with spirit. From the very earliest beginnings of mankind, I've had the good fortune, as Molly mentioned, to go return to Africa many times. So I have traveled through many of these areas in Tanzania, over in down here in Botswana, where the earliest fossilized evidence shows it to be the true cradle of civilization, in up here in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. I went and saw Lucy's bones, who was considered one of the earliest fossilized evidences of man's existence in Africa. Beyond that, though, there is a warmth and an energy, a real potency in Africa that embodies in a way my feelings and my feelings of the spirit of Africa, and that's what we hope to present a little of today. Most recently, I've been communicating with someone over the internet, a Canadian girl who's traveling to Africa for the first time this fall. And after only a few communiques, she said, "Oh, it sure sounds like you're enamored with Africa." And the answer is a resounding yes. I love Africa with every fiber of my being. And I love what the church can mean to Africa. Molly asked me to talk a little bit about the role of the church in Africa. And it is... it's an exciting time for Africans because of the way the church is growing there. We discussed this a little earlier. The first thing we want to do is sort of bemoan the fact that many Americans are so terribly ignorant about the continent of Africa. How many times have you heard people say the country of Africa? Because many people think that it's all one country, or maybe only one or two countries. They've heard of... they had a friend that went on safari in Kenya. Where's Kenya? I better get my glasses on here. Yeah, Kenya. I don't want to point to the wrong place. Then maybe they saw a movie, like someone commented on the movie of Out of Africa, and that also takes place in Kenya. Or perhaps they saw Humphrey Bogart and Catherine Hepburn in The African Queen, and that took place in the Belgian Congo. I can't even show you the Belgian Congo on the map, because there is no Belgian Congo. In fact, there are three Congos now, depending on, you know, it's the Democratic Republic of Congo and Congo, or Congo Zaire, Zaire Congo. So it is a very changing face of this continent, which is in itself very exciting. Another map here. This map slide. Resort to black and white. On this map, I have shown the chutzpah of kind of listing all the countries that I have been in. I have actually literally been in half, at one time or the other, half of the countries in Africa. I have visited and or lived in these countries. As she pointed out, I've had two postings with the Peace Corps. Both of those were in West Africa. When Sunstone asked me to limit my bio to 5 words, I got desperate measures and I put down RPCV. And I thought, well, they're not going to ever know what that is. But I noticed it's not on anything, so I guess I don't have to explain. But just for your FYI, that's a return Peace Corps volunteer. So the first time I was in the Gambia, which is this tiny little country right here, it just sticks in the side of Senegal. It is it's the country that surrounds the Gambia River. And the funny little story about that is that it is simply as wide, that country is as wide as the British cannons could reach on either side of the river. Because during the colonial struggles, the French had the stronger cavalry, they could hold the land. The British had the strongest navy, so they could hold the river and as far as their cannons would reach. And to this day, in Senegal, they refer to the Gambia as the sword in the side of Senegal. Then in the mid-90s, I went back again to Côte d'Ivoire, which is, you might know as Ivory Coast. And it was in Côte d'Ivoire that I worked on the guinea worm eradication. And I get to show off my dress because of that. This is material. It's very common in West Africa. Different projects or groups and like churches will have material made. And you'll see ones with, you know, Mary, Mother of Jesus, and praying things for the different churches, and the different medical centers will have them. Well, this was our guinea worm material, although this was not from Côte d'Ivoire where I work. This is actually from Mali. I have material from Côte d'Ivoire, but the color's not nearly as nice. And when I saw the Mali material, I told the Global 2000 consultant, I want your material. Purple is my favorite color. So I have my guinea worm, and it shows the woman filtering her water, which was one of the things we were teaching for guinea worm. Now, I warned Molly, I have a picture, and those of you who have squeamishness about terrible medical pictures may want to close your eyes, but I can't come and talk about the work I've done in Africa without showing you guinea worm. So we have the guinea worm, which is here, coming out of a foot. It normally comes out of the lower limbs, the lower leg, or the arms. I've seen it come out almost anywhere, but that's the most frequent place. And this is one that hasn't been treated or cared for, and obviously secondary infections have caused this huge wound. And this is a problem that Global 2000 has been addressing and trying to eradicate worldwide. Pakistan has been successful, Pakistan and India. Africa's lagging a lot behind, but hopefully they will in due time. Now another kind of a nicer little picture. Well, this was my house in the Gambia. This was my landlord pointing at it. He had just taken the money I'd given him for cement for the latrine and paid somebody to paint this blue design on it. And I was really upset because I liked it better white. I told him I liked it better white. But I'm sure it was a friend of his that he thought he'd give this job to. So they painted it inside and out, this very busy design. And I did make them repaint it white inside. I said, okay, you can leave the outside, but the inside has to. I can't live with that. And then I had to go get more cement. The latrine was important. I have lived in villages without electricity or running water. This one, for example, Kabakama, which was right outside it was not far from a large trading center, which did have electricity, but it was off more than it was on, so it didn't. Sometimes it's easier to just live without it, adjust your life to it, than to have it and sometimes and not have it other times. That gets very difficult. But in East Africa, I've also been involved in some short-term private volunteer projects. And I've worked, lived, and traveled in many remote areas as well as the sprawling capitals. I have been blessed with a unique opportunity of interfacing with Africans intimately through some of the same period that the church was expanding exponentially in Africa. And that has really, truly been a marvelous experience. So the question comes up, I guess, why Africa? Let's put it back here. Why was I so fascinated with Africa? And now the skeletons are going to come out of the closet. Growing up in the church during my formative years, The church policy on blacks was a major point of conflict with my mother. We went the rounds many a time. In due time was what she said. In due time was not supposed to mean in her lifetime, though. This was way, way off in the future. So I'm sure this fueled my early fascination with the, as we call it, the dark continent. So I'll give you some historical perspectives here. Let's look at what's happening. Okay. June of 1978, the revelation by President Kimball. Well, I was somewhere in Central America at the time and heard nothing about it. So when I got to Trinidad in September, I was in the bank and I ran into a couple of missionaries. Well, I greeted them and had an exchange. Never occurred to me to ask, why are you here? Trinidad is slightly less than 50% black and a little bit greater than 50% East Indian. So I guess I just assumed they were there preaching to the Indians, you know. They weren't dealing with the blacks. I didn't know. Then 1 month later, or 2 months later, I guess, I was on a boat in Brazil going up the Amazon from Santarém to Manaus, and I borrowed a Time magazine from a kid on the boat, and there it is. I read about the Mormon Church is now going to give the priesthood to all worthy members. Well, I was pretty stoked. All worthy male members, right, excuse me. All worthy male members. Good point. I was pretty stoked. Well, when I got home, I found out my mother was not quite so stoked. This was indeed a cruel blow to her. And I think probably one of the strongest tests possible of her faith in her lifetime. This was not something she accepted very easily. But then, oh, that's right, we want to go on. Okay, so and then I went to the Gambia in 1983, and this is a time when the church was just opening up and expanding in great numbers in a lot of West Africa, not in the Gambia. West Africa, the coastal portions are predominantly Christian, and then the portions as you go closer to the Sahara and you go farther north, they are strongly, strongly Muslim. So in the area that I was in the Gambia, it was predominantly Muslim. The only presence of the church, there were two USAID families who would have their own little service in Banjul, and if I was in the capital on Sunday, I could go. But there were no missionaries or no other church presence there. But then when I went back in the mid-90s to Ivory Coast, at this time, it was just exploding in West Africa and moving into East Africa. And then just a couple of years later, I was in East Africa where it's now exploding there. So it is really, really going great guns.
What do you mean by exploding?
Exploding, the members, member-wise. I'm going to show you a few statistics a little later. I will tell you just one instance. Like in Cote d'Ivoire, they go out looking for the missionaries. They hear about the church, and they go out, the Africans go out looking for them, as opposed to them having to look for interested Africans. So the energy is there for the church to really, really grow. And in fact, when I was in Cote d'Ivoire, they compared it a lot to the early days of the church here in this country, that the members and the ones who were coming forth were the ones that were the elite. So they were growing by leaps and bounds. I'll get the map up again. We want to keep looking at Africa. It's a great place. We want to look at it. Let's see, there we are. So this is it. Like I said, it's across this coast, the coastal area here, is where it's predominantly Christian, and then as you move closer into the Sahara Desert, it is strongly Muslim. So this is the area where the church has just really taken off in West Africa. And I will, another little aside, after my second tour of duty in, which was Cote d'Ivoire, right here, my mother, the racist, in a peak of frustration, verbally asked me what she, I know, had been brooding over for 10 years since I first went to the Gambia. And that was, why do you go to Africa to help the blacks when there are plenty of whites right here in America you can help? So the very simple answer to that, though, is the question that goes to the heart of the impact of the church in that the church can have in Africa. As Americans, we have options for literally everything, opportunities everywhere. If I could say, honestly, no one who really wants an education need go without one. You might not get to go to the very Ivy League school of your choice. You might not even have grades to get into any school of your choice. But there is some school, and there's probably a government loan that you can help you if you don't have the money. No one who makes a concerted gesture to get ahead is held completely back, no matter how hard they try. Sadly, this is not the case in Africa. Only the very rich can obtain certain things, and sometimes even they are blocked. I can tell you the experience, like just a friend of mine in Kenya who's been trying to get a passport for 10 years. They put in their application, they pay their fee, and everything gets lost. And they have to go back and pay bribe money every so often to get it found and reactivated. Then they wait for a while, and then they go back and pay a little more bribe money. I don't know how much he has paid to date, but he has been working for 10 years and still does not have his passport. And this is someone who's an educated person, who has, you know, the funds to prove that they can travel, but they simply do not have these opportunities. So to me, this is a no-brainer. You know, it's like, why do I want to help people that, if they just tried a little bit, could get ahead? Why not help somebody that doesn't have that opportunity? So I would say, like I said to my mother, Americans don't need my help like the Africans do. My impact would be the most where the need was the greatest. And maybe that makes me a lazy person. I don't know. It's probably why I like riding a bicycle. You know, a little effort for a significant return, a little bit of pedaling, and it takes you very far. So I felt that if I go work with the Africans, then they're going to appreciate it, and we're all going to get a little farther along. There are some other frustrating aspects, but the village level individual in Africa, they are the ones that are, it's so terribly rewarding to work with them, because they recognize the opportunity, and they will do anything they can to take advantage of that opportunity. So it is with the church. Nowhere is there more appreciation for the values that the church promotes than in Africa. Even without the influence of the church and the strength of their faith, Africans are very, very patient and long-suffering. We used to tell stories in the Gambia when I was there that people would go out to take a bus somewhere. Well, maybe they didn't even know whether the bus was going to come today, tomorrow, whenever, but they would just patiently, they take all their belongings, they just camp out there, and they're just going to wait until the bus came and they could get it. Within the framework of the church, Africans are provided with a lot of the opportunities that are currently lacking in the disruption of post-independence colonial nations. The church can provide them with the raw materials that their corrupt governments continue to ignore. This, we were discussing it a little beforehand, and I'm rather opinionated, so it's probably best not to get in too much of a discussion with me, but the destructive influence of colonialism is very, very pervasive, and Africa is paying the price now and will pay the price for many years to come. This is another topic of great interest, and I referred to some of the leaders that I call them the legacy leaders. Many countries in Africa, well, the Cote d'Ivoire, for example, their independence came in 1964. They just 2 years ago at Christmas time had a coup that overturned the Bédié government, but that was the second president of their country since 1964. So this is part of the legacy that the colonial era left, is this the corrupt governments that are in place. But instead of going there, let's focus on the positive aspects of parallel interests. The key elements in the life of all Africans are completely in tune with those of the church, at the core of the church. Education, stability, inner strength, truth, historical perspectives, continuity, and love. For Africans aggressively seeking a better life, the church can offer new hope. It's a good thing I've got a long arm. No, it's okay. It's okay.
want to hear.
Push it higher.
Higher. Okay, I sure will. Yeah. Okay, let's skip the first one right now and go first into education. We mentioned a little bit about education. They recognize the importance of education. It's really a sad situation. I'm more familiar since the last 2 years I've been in East Africa, so I'm a little more familiar what's going on there right at this moment. And one of the current trends is for the governments to just keep taking away support, government support for education. And in Kenya, it's now down to the point where even the primary school children, in most cases, their parents have to pay for all of their education. A few very, very poverty-stricken villagers can get some help, but not very much. This, and you brought up this point about the women here, I'm glad to have that, because this is really, for all women, it's a very sad thing, because if you have three or four, or usually 8 or 10 children in Africa, and you can't afford to send them all to school, of course it's the boys that are going to go. And the ones that are going to be lacking the education frequently are the girls. While I was there in Botswana, the word came down that because Mugabe in Zimbabwe is desperate for foreign currency, he is now going to require that all families pay for the children's education in U.S. dollars. Well, they don't have U.S. dollars, so what does this mean? That means no education. And this is the trend rather than to increase the amount of education in most places. In Benin, there's kind of an interesting story. I was visiting another Peace Corps volunteer in northern Benin, and they had had a policy whereby only the boys could go to school. And they finally had pressure put on them from outside sources, I think a lot from different Peace Corps volunteers, from different agencies. So they said, okay, all right, we'll let the girls go to school. But the girls don't get desks or books. The boys get desks and books, but the girls have to sit on the floor up against the wall and get no books. So it doesn't encourage them to continue going when they are that, you know, that discriminated against. I mentioned the fact that the missionaries in Cote d'Ivoire, moving on to this next one, intrinsic religious nature, that they didn't even have to sometimes go out and knock on doors. I talked to the missionaries. They said, oh, it's really great. They come looking for us. They do something very smart in Cote d'Ivoire. They pair an African missionary, the ones from the surrounding countries, with a Westerner. And so they have the black with the white, and then with their white shirts and black, and Africans usually wear lots of colors, so these very black and white and their little badges. They said people are just constantly coming up to them on the street and they don't even have to knock on doors. They were baptizing between 80 and 100 a month when I was in Cote d'Ivoire. And when I came back, I talked to my nephew who served on a mission in France and worked. He's a hard worker. He worked diligently for 2 years. He said, I'd like to count four. He says, one was actually, the baptism took place the week after I left. I says, you can count that, Wally. You can count that. Four in 2 years. So I told him 80 to 100 in a month. He was just couldn't even believe it almost. So the Africans have a long tradition of religion engendering a very personal relationship with God. Religion is not a casual social involvement, but rather a deep inner commitment to the faith itself. Most Africans early on were animists, and this is a belief system that incorporates every individual component of daily life, and it's deep and it's intrinsic and it's there. In my travels, many Africans would ask me why so many, it depends on where you are, Mzungus if you're in East Africa, or Tubabs or Tubabus, in West Africa, why are so many of them atheists, they would say. Now, granted, a lot of their contact, the heavy predominance of their contact is with Europeans or Australian backpacker students. So this is a whole population that's probably reading the philosophical books, and it's kind of, you know, jump on the bandwagon, yes, I'm an atheist. But this is a very disturbing concept to an African, and I had many of them raise this subject with me. Why? How is this possible? How can they be atheists? You know, and they don't even understand what that is. What does it mean to be an atheist? They'd say, they are mystified and horrified by the very idea. So their attitude is very harmonious with mine. As a microbiologist who has studied the inner workings of the cell, and in fact, one research project I worked on in San Diego was literally that, was studying what we call the docking and the tagging of the molecule that is tagged to specifically direct it through a pathway to a particular target, to a particular organelle. There is no way you can tell me that this is random. There is a hand, a very well-organized hand, that has set this in motion. So to me, like Africans, atheism totally lacks credibility. As a scientist, I looked at this firsthand. Africans understand intrinsically there is a higher being, and he has a hand in everything. So they are very spiritually blessed individuals who have suffered immensely with great patience and are now well overdue their rewards, their spiritual rewards. The last one I've listed here I want to talk about now, and that's the selective criteria that they're using. They learned from their mistakes in Latin America, where they were at first went in and whoever wanted to join the church was accepted. And they didn't look at the issue of, would they be able to get out to church? How far isolated were they? Were they literate enough to read even some of the scriptures? Did they have any support mechanism? And so they had a great deal of recidivism. In Africa, they've gone in using selective criteria. They have to be able to go out to church. They have to be able to at least read the scriptures to a certain degree. They are trying to target those with leadership potential, because they realize that in order to really establish the church in the early days there, they need that leadership potential to keep it going. So they have not made that same mistake. And then that I would say, in Africa, their values are in place. They are ready for the church. I was fortunate enough in Ghana to meet the first member of the church there, William Johnson, who has been profiled in the Enzyme, I think, on several occasions. Wonderful little old man, and I can still hear his words ringing in my ears. He said, "I waited 14 years for the church to get here, but I was ready for them when they arrived." Now we'll skip up to the front and say, yes, families are the fundamental building blocks upon which their traditional society is erected. Pride in heritage and respect for their elders. This I found as I started as a very young girl traveling, I found that as I got older and older, I got more and more respect, and it got easier and easier to travel there than it did earlier. But they have a thirst for education and truth, which is compelling. We as Westerners fill our lives with trivia, stuff, and forensic living. I'm sure most of you have seen the bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys wins." I haven't figured out just what they win. But as Africans, they are far more concerned with basics. And for them, the church can make a profound difference in their daily existence. Statistics. Before I show you my statistics, I'll just tell you a little experience. Nowhere is this difference in pace and focus better exemplified than in greetings. Africans are very big on their greetings and long greetings. When I was in the Gambia, I was learning Mandinka, and I found it to be kind of difficult, but the first thing you learn are your greetings. So you go through and your greetings. Salam alaikum, alaikum salam, sumule, bibije, sukum kole, and they just do this rapid fire, and they'll go on for maybe 5-10 minutes of just greetings, just greeting each other. And then another thing they get into is this, they like to chant each other's name, and it's very polite. You take the other person, ture, ture, and they go, sise, sise, ture, sise, and they go back and forth. They love to hear their names being chanted. So they go on and on in these greetings. And then you start the conversation. But then, at any point in the conversation, could be 20 minutes later, it's not just acceptable, but
extraordinarily polite to go back and do greetings all over. And maybe two or three times in one conversation, you will go through greetings. Well, learning this language that I was finding difficult, it was like a saving grace to me. I would get to the point where my brain is just fried. I can't talk anymore. And it's like, but wait a minute, I can do greetings, and I don't have to think. I know my greetings. So you just go back, and you kind of rest your brain, you go through greetings, and then you start all over again. I thought it was kind of neat myself. But then I came back to the United States, and every store I'd go into, I'd go up to the shopkeeper, and I'd say, oh, hello, how are you, and how's your family, how's your village, how are your people, how are your dogs? They would get so irritated with me. What do you want? What is all this? Why do you want to know about me? Oh, because I've been in Africa, and this is normal. So, one of my favorite travel writers is Dervla Murphy, an Irish woman. And I was reading in South from the Limpopo, and she stated it so beautifully that I'm going to read to you. Without evading the grimness of life in much of modern Africa, one can recognize that this continent is not yet sick as our continent is sick. Most Africans remain plugged into reality. In contrast, we have become disconnected from it, reduced to compulsively consuming units taught to worship economic growth, the ultimate unreality in a finite world. And this is so true. You get those Africans that, oh, they want to go to America because the streets are all paved with gold. But basically, their main concern is, where's my next meal? What can I do to help out my family? Where can I, you see the little children all carrying their older brothers and sisters. Families are important, taking care of each other, reaching out to each other is central to their lives. So naturally, they would value the values of the church. Let's look at some statistics here. Now, I had a little trouble getting some of these statistics. And you'll see a lot of little empty spots here. And so I spent a week on the phone with different various and sundry offices in Salt Lake, and they literally told me that I was not allowed to have, I could have church-wide numbers for this, but I couldn't have regional numbers in Africa. And I could have gone deviously around, and I had some connections, but I decided not to, that it wasn't that important somehow. But it does show you, at least in the total number of members, and of course, here's 1978, when they started opening up the missions in Africa, and at that time there was only the one mission, which was in South Africa. And you see the increase, and I did finally get the number for 2000, which is 149,284. But to show it a little more clearly, during that 125-year period prior to 1853 to 1978, the church increased by 7,712 members, which is this. And then during the period of 1978 to 98, that two-year period, it increased by 112,344 members. So it was a big, big increase there. And they still only have the 12 missions. Many of the missions are all combined, like the Kenya mission, Ethiopia and Uganda and I believe Tanzania. The Zimbabwe mission includes Mozambique and Malawi, so a lot of the countries are all lumped together, so they don't have that many missions all together.
When they have the countries lumped together, do they have a common language? Or do the missionaries do? The missionaries just stay where they learn a dialect?
No, and predominantly, this is in East Africa where the missions are lumped together like that. And English, with the exception of Mozambique, English is pretty widely spoken. And again, with the selective criteria that they're using, the people that fit into that criteria are usually the ones that also speak English. In East Africa, this is it, the language situation, there's just hundreds of tribal languages. East Africa, the largest number of one language, any one language, is Swahili, which covers a lot of it. But you find the missionaries, and like I say, in Mozambique, obviously, they're speaking Portugal. But in most of the other areas, they're speaking English. In Ethiopia, which is part of the Kenya mission,
they had bilingual services. The missionaries would pretty much speak English, but maybe some take a translator out with them. Many of them did not learn the local languages. They're very, very difficult. The Amharic is, I think, one of the most difficult languages out there. Something like 200 alphabet characters, and it's really, really difficult. So, and even the church services were English with a translation into Amharic. So the missionaries themselves speak those languages. Yes?
Do they have
No, there are, as far as I know, there are no missionaries in Sierra Leone. In West Africa still, then there, Sierra Leone was a Christian country, but with the Civil War going on, predominantly they're also not even up in like Mali and Burkina and the Gambia and Senegal. They're concentrated in Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigeria. And I did not get into Cameroon, so I don't know about Cameroon. But and then again, see now, like even Peace Corps in Cote d'Ivoire, for instance, we didn't even learn a local language. I did learn a local language in the Gambia. There's only about 5 local languages in the Gambia, 2 of them very strong, which is Wolof and Mandinka. In Cote d'Ivoire, however, because of the nature, let's look at the map again. I like the map up there when we're looking at all these countries. Cote d'Ivoire, they were populated later, and it was waves of Africans coming in from some of the great kingdoms that existed, the Songhai Kingdom up in Mali and some of the others. They migrated down, and so they have more languages almost than many of the other countries because of it. And so even for Peace Corps, they didn't bother to teach us the local languages, except you usually learned greetings in an area where you were. And we did all of our work in French, because pretty much French is spoken throughout the country. And it is the same when you get into a lot of the other... I found traveling through Mali and Burkina Faso and all, French got me through just fine. I never had any problem. If you go way, way out into the villages, you know, there'll be a certain amount of the people that don't speak French, but there's always someone. There's always that language available. So,
what's the population?
The total population? I do not know. I do not know. And that's a good question. I wish I could tell you. But brings us down to what do Africans want? Africans want what's real. Africans want education and opportunities for personal development. So what more fertile ground could the church have? So, just what is the role of the church? Okay, it leaves us with, all right, personal achievement, education, family unity, genealogy. Hey, don't these sound real familiar? You know, aren't these the same areas that the church plays an important role in the lives of all members? So what makes Africa special? What makes it different? Where is the distinct divergence? And I would say it is the intensity of the impact that makes such a difference. A simple matter of passion, vigor, and force supplied by the Africans themselves. Those who have faced the greatest need will experience the greatest satisfaction. Traveling into Ghana, my first trip into Ghana from Cote d'Ivoire, after I'd been in Cote d'Ivoire only a few months, and the mission president in Abidjan told me, he says, well, just as you go down into the road, goes down into Cape Coast, right there at the fork of the road is a brand new chapel. Look for it when you go by. So I was on a bus, and I'd been chatting with this kid next to me, nice young man. And as we're passing by, I'm looking over, and he looks over, and he says, that's a church. I said, yes, thank you very much. I said, that's my church. I thought he was going to jump out of his seat. That's my church, too, he says. And he'd been a member for 10 years, he'd served his mission, and he was the one who took me all around Cape Coast, introduced me to the primary president and the branch president's first counselor, and he was the one who introduced me to Patriarch Johnson, who then told me his experience of getting the Book of Mormon and the experience that he had of then converting a group and having them all ready when the church did arrive. But it was exciting to him. And I find that so many of them. Once they do find out what the church can mean for them, there's just no stopping them. They're just into it. I got a overhead that just with some of my own personal impressions, and this feeds into the same thing what we're dealing with there. And this is, I'm sure, one of the reasons that I love Africa so much. There's a simplicity. There is an acceptance. You do not have peer group pressure. You do not have people trying to step on you to get somewhere. They have to help each other or they get nowhere. They have great patience. They have great adaptability. They have freedom from convention and very uncluttered, uninhibited lives. So this makes them very good prospects. Now, one of the things that Molly wanted me to mention, and I kind of as an afterthought, here, this is from Côte d'Ivoire, which is where I was for 2.5 years. And this is Abidjan that's in the background, the city of Abidjan. It's kind of an interesting city because it's a lot of international banking, huge buildings. And if you look at it, like from the distance like this, you look at it and you think, whoa, man, it's New York City, put down in Africa. And then you walk around in the streets and you know you're not in New York City. But
is it mineral wealth? Where do they get the money to build these skyscrapers?
They were economically very, very secure after independence. It's agriculture predominantly, but they're somewhat of the banking center. Now, some of my best friends in Abidjan when I was there was a couple from Senegal, and he was in international banking, and they had been transferred there. So it's kind of the business center. And
is it local wealth, or is it owned by people outside the country?
A lot of it's both. There's a lot of local wealth. All through Africa, there's a lot of local wealth. We think of it as being poor, but it's concentrated in the hands of very few. But those few are extraordinarily wealthy. I was told when I was in Zimbabwe a year ago that Mugabe, if he were to take all of his wealth and give, he has enough to give every man, woman, and child in Zimbabwe $1 million and still have money left over. That's how much he has. So this is it. The wealthy are not just slightly wealthy. They are humongously wealthy. And then the poor are very, very poor. But back to the ways, what we discussed, the ways to help. And she was concerned, how can we send things over? We all hear, oh, the packages go over. And then there's a little bit of a joke that a lot of churches, other churches, they send packages of clothing over. Well, they find their way to the market very quickly. And they have almost every major market has what they call the dead man's market. And these are used clothes, the dead man's market. And so it is a real concern to send a package. First of all, it meets up with a problem right at the port, because if you're not there as the boat comes in, hands out, and with a little bribe to make sure that nobody opens it, then they're going to go in and take what they want. So from every point, and then it gets to the whatever agency. Well, if you don't know and you don't have responsible, reliable people there, it's going to get filtered off. I was telling them about the experience with my guinea worm project. And everyone but one, there was one individual who wasn't. We're all stealing from the project. The secretary was stealing the supplies and selling them. She was selling computer time, and people would come in and bring disks, and we had no no virus program. And I said, you're going to bring the computer down, and then the way I could get to her is, then you won't be able to sell the time at all. So, and she would also do work for other people on the project time, and I said, and then all those people that you're typing for, you won't get that money, so think about this. But they were all stealing from the project. The one man would put in for a per diem to go out to do. He was doing the work with the spraying of some of the smaller marigots, which a marigot is literally what we would call a mud puddle, but it was the water where they were getting their drinking water. And he put in for 30 days of per diem, go out for one or two days, and then disappear to his home village and never be found, you know, not surface until the end of the 30 days. So they were all stealing from them. And this is very common. So you do need to deal with an agency that you know has someone in place on site. And this is why I made the suggestion also. Many times you can go through Peace Corps volunteers. And most cities have groups of returned Peace Corps volunteers that meet not just socially, but also sponsor projects and raise money for other Peace Corps volunteers, because they know that if a Peace Corps volunteer is in a village in place monitoring this project, then it's going to be reliable and there's going to be accountability. And one of the things that Peace Corps was doing in Cote d'Ivoire, we're raising money, raising funds, and we had a fund, what was Women in Development Fund, and we sponsored girls for further education, because many times they'll be able to somehow get through primary school, but at that point they're expected to either get married or help on the fields or do something. It was not important for them to have education. So Peace Corps, depending upon how much funds we were able to raise for the year, would select, and they had to be recommended by the village. They had to have good grades. They had to meet a lot of criteria, and then they would sponsor them for school. And many projects, well digging projects, a number of them, there are groups here that target someone that is responsible, that's there to oversee the funding. And if you do it that way, it is quite possible to give aid, to give help in Africa. And I also mentioned, I have a friend who lives in Blantyre, Malawi. She's British, and she's a midwife, nurse practitioner. So she does a lot of community action work and works with a lot of these groups. So I visited a number of them, and one in particular that's funded by Danish funds. And they have a British couple. And I was absolutely just overwhelmed with what they did to absolutely secure the money and make sure that all of the funding went properly in place. And they went over and above the call of duty. They would locate local people who they could bring in on the project, and they would bring local people in so they could make the money go even farther, and they would bargain for things, and they would go around, and if they needed materials for building, they would go and get discarded materials. They did everything they could to try to make sure that the funding went for what it was meant for. And they were doing some very wonderful work with children from birth to 2 years that were either orphans or otherwise didn't have a home situation, and many of them were AIDS, HIV positive children. So I have personally been able to observe groups who are doing wonderful work, and the money is going to the right source. So you don't have to just automatically assume that everything is going wrong. If you're dealing with the governments, and if you're dealing at that level, you can pretty much assume. And I told them the experience of Cote d'Ivoire. There was, when I was working on Guinea worm, there was one man with WHO, that the word was out. He's honest, because he only takes a tiny little bit. But he had to take something, or his colleagues would not accept him. They would just write him off, wouldn't work with him, because that made him a traitor. He was betraying them. So he took just the tiniest little bit to let himself be part of the old boys network or whatever it is. And we considered he was an honest man. But unfortunately, it is all too prevalent that they take about as much as they can get. Yes?
Would you comment on HIV?
Oh, that's a big comment. Comment on the fact that yes, it is there. And the question is, I'm being asked to comment on HIV/AIDS in Africa, and it's like anything anywhere else. Each country has a little bit different situation. This trip, I was in Botswana. Botswana, up until like last year, I think it was last year or the year before, refused to acknowledge that AIDS was even there. They refused to even address the issue. They refused to look at anything. They refused to have any education. They refused to even have a condom program. And when they did look at it, come to find out, they, because of that, they now have, they do have the highest, one of the highest rates or percentages of AIDS in all of that, certainly that region of Africa. Right next door in Namibia, where they've been willing to acknowledge it and look at it, and something that I was very, very pleased to see, the billboards and the posters that they have, unlike even America, where they say, oh, well, we can't promote, you know, celibacy. Nobody's going to accept that. That is their number one method. They say that is the number one method to AIDS. The second one is faithfulness, to be faithful to your partner, and it's not to leave it to the third method is condoms. So they're promoting celibacy and promoting it very hard, and as a result, their percentages are much lower. When I was in Cote d'Ivoire, they estimated that the prostitutes in Abidjan, if they had been on the streets for as long as 6 weeks, 100% of them were HIV positive. One of the other big problems in Africa is it's a big stigma there, just like it is and has been in this country. It's a stigma. So they don't want to, they don't even call it AIDS, and of course they don't have the testing means. If the tests are available, they're too expensive or they're way far away, they don't even have travel money to get to the testing center. So they don't test, they don't know, but in many cases it's quite obvious, but they don't even refer to it as AIDS. It's called Slim disease. And oh yes, they died of Slim disease, or it's attributed to one of the secondary infections, predominantly TB. And of course there's a lot of TB in non-HIV positive patients, so it's very prevalent as well. But there's a very big stigma, and within a compound, you see someone just wasting away, but no one ever talks. So out in the villages, they simply don't talk about AIDS. One of the exceptions to this is the area in southern Uganda, where they have been so hard hit. And through there, of course, there's whole villages that have been, the middle generation has been completely wiped out. You have only the very, very old and the young orphans, many of whom are HIV positive. And so I went out into the Sese Islands, which is on Lake Victoria. I don't have my map up. And out there, most families are supporting between 10 and 15 orphans apiece because there are so many orphans that have been left. But they have, in the last several years, they have just taken on, just head on, they've tried to attack this problem, and they're radically bringing the numbers down. So it's kind of like everywhere. Where the government has not backed off and said, we're going to bury our heads in the sand and we're not going to acknowledge this even exists. In those countries where the government has said, yes, it's here, and okay, we got to do something about it, they are bringing numbers down. They are doing a lot of good work. While I was in Africa this last time, the king of Swaziland came on the radio and gave a speech. And the whole gist of it was, real men don't get AIDS. So if you're a real man, you won't get it. And promoted that horrible myth, but if for some reason you do think you have it and you suspect it, if you sleep with a virgin, it will cure it. And this is the king of the country presenting this philosophy.
What's that, the democratic government? Do they have in these different? Well, is each one different?
Let's get Africa up there. Yeah. Let's get Africa up there. Yeah.
I mean, is there law and order?
5 minutes. We're all good. Pardon?
Is each land got its different type of?
Yes. Yes. Most of them now have presidents. Swaziland and Lesotho, which are completely within South Africa, are unique. Here's Lesotho, and where's Swaziland? Pretoria. It's right up here. They both have kings. But there are about the only ones I know that still, most of them have presidents. Depends upon who colonized them. If they were British, they usually have a president and a prime minister. It's based a lot on the British system. If they were French, they'll have a president and a series of ministers. So it does vary.
It seems like there is that the social structure for the church to be there?
The social structure for the church?
There's no democracy there.
Well, there's a one-party democracy. We don't call it, you know, it's not a democracy. They call it a democracy. But the church doesn't need that.
Well, it needs law and order to be there.
It needs law and order, it needs law and order for anyone to live. There are some places that it's out of control. The rate is rising in South Africa and Nairobi. But for the most part, it's, you know,
I know, I saw six missionaries about four blocks from Temple Square in Salt Lake City the other day. I think they would be better sent to Africa than to Salt Lake City. Why doesn't the church do something like that if they have all that prospectus down there? They've had missionaries in Salt Lake City for 150 years.
That's true. But they do have a lot of missionaries in Africa. Like I said, I couldn't find out exactly how many, but they would not tell me by region, like I said. I've never traveled in a single country in Africa that I haven't seen missionaries at some time. I've run into them everywhere. So they are there.
Are other Christian churches like Jehovah's Witnesses?
Oh, yes. They're all through.
Are they proselyting?
Proselyting.
Are they successful like the Seventh-day Adventists?
Yes. Yes, they have huge congregations. And this area, when I traveled, the first time I traveled across this area, and especially in Ghana, every few meters was a different church. And small churches, individuals. The church of the universal belief in God. The church where God looks into your eyes and says you are good. I mean, the bizarre names, it was quite entertaining. And just constantly along the road. So they have a long tradition of history of Christian missionaries. Dr. Livingston, I presume, you know, he was one of the early Christian missionaries. So they do have this long tradition. Well, we need to close. We've talked a lot about the people, and a lot of people think that there are no people in Africa. There's only animals. Well, we focused on the people. So I want you to know, in spite of all the poaching, in spite of losing 80% of the elephants in East Africa during those 10-year period before the CITES agreement, there still are a few animals left. And just for those of you who want something to chuckle about for the last final 15 symptoms of chronic Peace Corps withdrawal. And some of the ones that I really like is feeling nostalgic when your commuter bus is filled to overcapacity. Considering yourself better informed about developing countries than top-level State Department officials. And this one, too. Subscribing to magazines normally found only in libraries. Reaching for the pepper before the salt. I do love my pili pili. Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, we've taken all our time, but I have a good feeling that Catherine would be happy to answer your questions after the session. We'll let the other people come in the next one, but in the halls and all, I'm sure she'll be happy. Thank you all for coming.
I was afraid I wouldn't be long enough.
yes. Georgia, very much. What organizations did you work with?
Well, I was with Peace Corps twice in West Africa. Right. And then in East Africa, I've just gone on my own. I worked in a research lab in Ethiopia, and it was run by the government there, and I just went over and inquired around and left my resume and found it. And then in Malawi and also in Mozambique, I worked with through small community action projects. A friend of mine who does it in Malawi connected me with some people, so it was just things I found when I got there.
Did you see any of the church welfare missionaries there or
no.
humanitarian?
No, I didn't. And the church welfare project, obviously they're helping people, but because of the selected criteria, a lot of the members that they are getting now are not actually the ones that would really need them. They're the ones that are the strong, you know, leader, have the leadership qualities and are... I think in due time they will, you know, the outreach will be greater. But I think it's very wise because to really get the foundation started, those are the ones they need. And they say that, like I said, in Cote d'Ivoire was where I worked most closely with the church and was helping with some of the teacher training. It was amazing that the people that were flocking to the church were the just the top quality. They were the ones that, you know, you really could see the, you know, the potential in them. Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure.
What years did you say you were in the Gambia?
I was in the Gambia in 1983.
Oh, okay.
That's where Alex Haley.
Yes.
Business.
Yes. Exactly. That's where Roots. Oh. It was right after Roots. It was right after Roots came out, and I went there.
Because I have a friend who was over there with the Unification Church.
Oh, uh-huh, okay.
So, and what kind of towns or that were you in?
Well, I was. See, I was way upriver. Like I said, the country is just as wide as the Canada
yeah.
reach. So it's a narrow country, and the length of the river. I was up towards the top, towards Senegal. And in a tiny little village was my posting. It was Kaba Kama, K-A-B-A-B-A, comma, K-A-M-A. But it was right outside a large trading center, which is Basse Santa Sue, is actually, but B-A-S-S-E, Basse. And anyone who's
okay.
been in the Gambia will know
okay.
Basse. Basse is a large... It's a crossroads
yeah.
from Senegal. The Senegambia Road runs
oh.
through there. So they have a lot of traffic, and the agriculture moves through there, and it was a large trading village. And in fact, it was close enough to me. In my village, I didn't have any lined wells, rather. They were all unlined. So rather than take unsafe water, chances of unsafe water, and you can't really afford to boil it all the time because you can't get